Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Put a spring in your step and fresh looks in your home, in-store or online at harrycurry.com.
0818 715 815.
Hello, good afternoon, and you're very welcome to Liveline. And 51551 is our text number. As we remarked during the speech by the Taoiseach yesterday at beginning 15 minutes hence 2 o'clock yesterday, he mentioned the fact that Caroline Carey, who was 17 at the time, was pregnant, and the family, this had been known previously, but the family specifically asked the Taoiseach to mention the unborn child, and the unborn child being, as the Taoiseach referred to the baby, as the 49th victim of the Stardust. And as we know, the Stardust tragedy has never, those flames have never been extinguished, Tricia O'Connor. Tricia, good afternoon.
Hi, Joe.
How are you? Tricia, you were in the Stardust, but you have a special memory of poor dear Caroline who died.
I do, Joe, yeah. I went down with Caroline that night. Yeah. Myself and Angela and Caroline, yeah. And Joe, you're right. You know, like for all these years, I always knew there was 49. I always knew. And it was always spoken about in our families that there was 49. You know, but like to hear her, being acknowledged yesterday.
Yeah.
You know, and because that she deserved that, and her family deserved that.
Yeah.
So to hear that I finally acknowledged yesterday was just brilliant. You know, like, not brilliant, but you know what I mean? It was just
an achievement.
The family, they deserved it. You know what I mean?
A milestone, I suppose, is one way of looking at it. I take your point. But Patricia, were you big pals with Caroline?
Yeah, like, she was going out with the fella that lived next door to me.
Okay.
You know? And, yeah, and we went up that night to call for her, and we all went down. I ran down the road, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And, you know.
And was Caroline keen to go?
Of course she was keen to go. Everyone was keen to go to the Stardust, Joe.
Yeah.
That was the place to be.
Yeah.
It was brilliant. It was absolutely brilliant. You know what I mean? And like, you know.
And was Caroline's mother, was she keen for Caroline to go?
And my memory is not, Joe.
Okay.
The memory is that, you know, that she was grounded that night. I've never had this conversation with her family.
Yeah.
That's my memory.
Okay.
And will you go down and ask me ma? Will you go down and ask me ma again? And because it was the dancing competition. So we went down, as you do, oh, please, I swear to God, we'll be back, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
all
yeah.
that. And then we just ran off down the road, you know what I mean? She was beautiful, Joe. She was the good-looking one in the group, you know what I mean? She really was. And she was just great fun. She was, you know, she just had a personality that it was exuberant, you know what I mean? So, like.
So you went around to the Stardust, you paid your £3 in.
£3 in,
And what are your memories? Like, there was obviously a lot of fun up to after midnight, but what are your memories of the night, Tricia? You and Caroline.
So we went in, and Caroline, the other girl, Angela, went to the bar. I went up to the seat. Caroline went to meet her fella at the time. You know,
okay,
what I mean? She said she was going, and she was meeting other friends. Everybody was just, you know, doing that thing, Joe.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Everybody was just happy and meeting their other friends, and you know, and I went up the back, you know, because the seats that we would have normally sat in, you know, it was so packed. We just went up the back.
And the seats are, they stepped up, didn't they? You went higher and higher.
That's where I was, stepped up, you know, up the back, right up. And so, you know, when it happened and the place went into complete darkness and you could just hear screams and, you know, mommy, help me, dad. Oh, it was just, the echo, as you said, the flames don't go away. The sounds don't go either, Joe.
Yeah.
They don't, you know. And so I managed to get out. Thankfully, I managed to get out. I didn't think at the time, you know what I mean? I'm so grateful now. And the people that have, the women, like, that have battled for this all this year, enabled me to sit in that court, you know, and hear that verdict the other day and be in the Dáil yesterday, to have that verdict, to hear it, like, you know, I heard the words, I heard the apology, I definitely heard the verdict in the court from the jury and from the judge, but those women enabled me, them, all the people that have, to hear that, and I'm just grateful, I'm alive to be able to hear it, like, you know, so many weren't, Joe, you know what I mean, just...
And Tricia, when did you realise that there was a fire?
We just looked across at our tent. The DJ made an announcement, but someone else drew me attention to it, and it was just a tiny little thing, Joe. It wasn't too far high.
Okay.
It was under a sea, and it looked miles away from me, you know. But by the time I stood up, turned around, so you're counting that. And turned back around, the place was in total darkness.
Wow.
I had 58% of my body burnt, but I wasn't burnt by fire, Joe. It was what was dripping and all the rest. So I could hear the fire, but couldn't see the fire. You know, it wasn't flames that I was burnt by, you know.
And what are your memories of getting out, Tricia? Of escaping?
I held on to a fella's feet that was in front of me. He said, get on the floor. I got on the floor. I held on to his feet. When he moved, I moved.
Wow.
Try not to open your mouth. It was palpable, the smoke. It was just palpable. And then got to the door, and then a piece of wood off the ceiling fell on me back. So I was sort of trapped inside the door for a bit. And then I got out, you know what I mean? But getting out, I'm glad I got out. At the time, I was young, I was 16. I didn't understand. I didn't want that body. I didn't want that body, you know, that I was left with. So it wasn't a pretty body, Joe, you know? So.
And where you sit, when you got out, Tricia, and you hear, obviously, as you say, the sounds, the noises, the screams, the fire engines coming or whatever. When did you realise that you were, as you say, 58% of your body was burned?
Yeah.
When did you realise how serious
I suppose I looked, I was walking on something, Joe, and it was just skin off my arms and my hands, and a fella that brought me to the car, that put me in the car, that brought me to the hospital, he just picked it up, the skin, and wrapped it around my arms. I couldn't breathe. He cleared my throat. You know, I got to the matter. And then I was in intensive care. So I really only realised when I came out of intensive care. And, you know, so it wasn't, there's no real realisation that, look, I'm burnt, because, you know, It's just a pain you can't describe. It's mentally, you know. So the hospital, in a way, was safe. There was so many things that had to happen. And people who were injured know what I'm talking about. The scrapings, the board, the skin grafts, the whole thing, you know. And it's just a process of pain, Joe. I'm not going to lie, you know. So that's what it was, you know.
Trish, when did you realise that Caroline was missing?
I wasn't told anybody was dead for a while, Joe.
Oh, were you not?
No. My mummy told me then, and when I was in hospital, a while before I was due to get out, there was talk in the hospital, but it wasn't so much, you know. And then my mummy told me that there was that Caroline was dead. You're 16. You don't, dead doesn't make sense. You know, it just doesn't, until really when I went back to Coolock, that's when the real enormity hit of, like, because it was changed. There was just an air hanging over the place. It was just awful, because there was just so many. There was so, and these were real live people. Yeah. These were people, you know. Like, you can say the 48, the 49, these were people like that. You saw every week, you saw a Northside, yeah. They worked in Superquin. These were all the people that you saw on a daily basis, and they were just gone, you know, just gone, you know. So,
and along with in hospital for Tricia?
Oh, God, 7 weeks, I think, yeah. 8 weeks, yeah, you know, but... Yeah. So, but Caroline, there's not a day goes by when I don't see her face. I don't think about her. I don't think about her family. Mm-hmm. You know, because there was it was a long time. I didn't even want to go up the road by our mammy's, and it was nothing got to do with that. It was like I came home. You know what I mean? She didn't. Mm-hmm. She didn't come home. So. You know, it took a while then for that to, you know.
And Trish, you know the way you said to me, you held on to some chap, I don't said get on the ground,
yeah.
Which was
Tony was his name.
Okay,
yeah.
And have you kept in touch with him? Did you know who he was?
No, absolutely. I do know who he was, but I've not seen him. And I actually put it down to him. And another fella, Christy Riley, for saving my life that night, Joe. You know what I mean? Because, like, left to my own devices when I stood up outside that door, I wasn't capable of doing anything. I wasn't capable of cleared me airways. I wasn't capable of wrapping the skin around my arms. I wasn't capable of doing any of that. You know, so these people, and now, sadly, we have had no contact. My life went off in a very different road.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? You know?
But you were 16, Tricia.
16, yeah.
And you
16.
Said...
It's like, yeah. I'm sitting there yesterday, Joe. I was 16 again when I was hearing some of the emotional speeches that were going on. I'm looking around me at the people that were there. And, you know, I'm seeing faces, tired faces. But I was looking at them saying, my God, they never gave up.
Yeah.
But I was a woman walking out there, Joe. I was a grown woman walking out yesterday. And that's something that I've achieved from this, you know?
That's incredible.
Yeah.
Incredible.
You know?
And Trish, how soon after the time you were in hospital, how soon after did you realise you had such extensive burns?
I realised... Joe, when I couldn't do anything for myself, when I was stuck to the bed in the mornings and my ma had to peel me off. And I don't mean that to be dramatic, Joe, but that's what happened to us. You know what I mean? Like, because you'd be just stuck and the bandages would be stuck. And so I couldn't use my hands at the time, you know, and because there were bandages. You went to hospital every day to get the dressings changed. And, like, but, a dependency on other people for everything, you know. Mm. And then as they're getting better, you know, people scratch me back. You scratch here, scratch the bones. You know, so I realised it ruined relationships in my life, you know what I mean? It affected my children, my family, everybody. It seeped into everybody, you know, the stardust and what happened that night. It just seeped in, you know what I mean? And it's still there. It's been generational. It's been generational for us all, for everybody. It's been generational. And I just hope now, you know, that my grandkids will, you know, they'll have a different viewpoint now of this.
Yeah, of course.
They'll have a different, you know. Yeah,
and when, Tricia, difficult. When did you look at yourself in the mirror after, for the first time? Do you remember that when you realised the extent of the burns to your body? Did you look at yourself in the mirror?
No, Joe.
Okay.
I don't like. That's really put me on the spot.
No,
I don't. I don't look at me. No, I can see me hands. I can see me arms. I don't look at me back. I don't look. You know what I mean? So, and that's the way it has destroyed relationships in my life. And you know, so.
And you're giving people a glimpse of what people have gone through, what survivors have gone through, Tricia.
Well, that's survivors, yeah. You know, and that's the reality. You know what I mean? Like, I know I'm not alone in this. I am not alone in the feelings I have and the not looking at my body and hiding my body all my life, hiding and being glad, oh, the only thing you can see is my hands. That's grand. That's, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. But, like, you know, it's just, like, it's just been, it's just, the stardust has just been, It's on me. On me, and now it's lifting. It's lifting.
Brilliant.
You know.
Brilliant.
It's lifting. You know.
Oh, you're remarkable. You really are. You really are. Because I've spoken
we
to.
We all a, are.
I know you are, and I've spoken to another survivor, and I'm thinking, Antoinette Keegan, as you know, and Christine, I've spoken to them over the years. But one of the things that Antoinette told me over the years, it was on this radio program, she had survivor's guilt. Her two sisters.
That's what happened regarding Caroline. That's what happened. And it's hard to describe, Joe, because it's like you're nearly feeling sorry for yourself, but it's not that, Joe. It's like I went out with that girl that night and she never came home. You know, sorry. And it's just, you know, we walked up, we called for her, we left the house, we went there laughing, joking, all done up, delighted in our clothes. You know what I mean?
Valentine's night, it was disco time, there was dancing competitions.
It was great. Yeah. But to finally get that verdict the other day that no one did anything wrong, none of us.
Of course.
So that's what it was, it was a vindication, even though we all knew. But it was just like, it's out there now. It's written in words, you know, that way.
It's,
you know?
It's carved in stone.
It's carved
Tricia.
In stone.
It'll never be erased. Never be erased.
Yeah, about time, you know.
And I don't. You see, we can't. Say how it impacted on the population. Now I think it's impacting on people. very, very much now, especially people who weren't around then. But Antoinette has spoken openly of survivor's guilt and of wanting to end her own life, that she felt so guilty for no reason. It's a phenomenon. It's known as survivor's guilt. She survived. Unfortunately, her sisters didn't. You survived. Unfortunately, Caroline didn't. But everyone did their best and no one was to blame. Everyone was unlawfully killed, Tricia.
Unlawfully killed.
Caroline Carey, your pal, was unlawfully killed.
She was unlawful. She didn't deserve to die like that. She didn't deserve to die and then deserve to die like that. None of them did. Yeah. Absolutely none of them did. Like, it's still mind-boggling to me. It's still something I struggle to wrap my head around, that, like, you know, they all died in there, you know? And it's just, you know, and some of them together, you know? So that was the extent of the spirit of people back then, the community back then, holding on to each other. So, and that's how a lot of people got out. Holding on to each other too, you know.
And
the women and that have carried this campaign, and I know men have too.
Yeah, yeah.
But they're just unbelievable, Joe. You know, they've given me my life to be able to be sitting there in where I am now, in a really good place, thankfully, and to hear that verdict, you know. And I wouldn't have got it otherwise, only for all those campaigners. Not a chance, you know.
But to say to me, Tricia, that when you went in over the last few days, you went in as a 16-year-old, but you came out yesterday as an adult.
That's the only way I can put it into words. I felt like a grown woman.
Yeah.
I just felt I'm a grown woman, you know. And because sitting there listening, I was back there. I'm not alone in that. I know people were back there too. And I was emotional. And then it was just hearing the words, you know, and, you know, just the acknowledgement of 49, you know, it's well deserved. It's taken so long, you know.
Yeah. Say with us, Tricia. I'm thinking as well when we were talking about that phrase, the names of Caroline's name and the 48 and now 49 victims as properly acknowledged. They are now, I know they were engraved in stone in Bonnybrook. I know they are engraved in stone in the memorial in Beaumont. I don't know whether you've ever seen it. There is a little memorial. Well, it's a fine little memorial in Beaumont Hospital. And I mentioned yesterday that one of the names, Josephine Glenn, has been, through no fault of anyone, Tricia, as you know, Beaumont wanted to put up a memorial. They did it. I think it was about 25 years ago, because I mentioned I was there for the Gay Bourne show and Christy Dignam sang Imagine, and it was very moving.
That's right,
But one of the names, Josephine Glenn, has two N's instead of one N, G-L-E-N. And our family were deeply upset, and it hasn't been changed. So we're going to try and get it changed. And also it's for the N to be removed and the name to be spelled correctly. It also means hopefully that whatever improvement or cleaning or organising has to be done in Beaumont, I'm sure we'll get people to help us. Tricia, stay with us, because what hospital are you in again, Tricia? The Mater?
Well, I was in the Mater on Stevens's.
Stevens, okay. Well, we've a nurse who worked in the Mater, and she'll talk to us after the break. Stay there. Joe at rt.ie.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Rosemary, good afternoon.
Hi, good afternoon, Joe.
Yeah, good, and you're on a great line. You were in the Mater Hospital, and what age were you, Rosemary, when you began walking there?
Yeah, I had just gone to Dublin. I was after training in Cork, and I suppose I was 20, or just turning 22 that May, and I had just registered with an agency in Dublin, a nursing agency, so I'd only arrived in Dublin the week before the Stardust disaster. So when that happened, then one of my first shifts actually in Dublin was in the Mater, looking after two patients that had been moved out of ICU, probably to make space for more critically ill patients, say, from the Stardust fire. So I suppose I found that a bit daunting as a,
so you
know,
arrived,
just a trained
nurse. You arrived in Dublin to begin your work on the weekend of the Stardust.
More or less, maybe the Thursday or the Friday, and I'd registered with this agency, and say the hospital then brought in, I suppose, agency nurses to cope with the, you know, extra demands, and I was looking after these two gentlemen, but later on then, I suppose, I was staying up around Phibsborough and St. Peter's Road there. An accommodation, and I suppose a lot of the shifts then were in the Mater because it was so local to me. And then in April and May, then I specialed Jimmy Fitzpatrick. I know he's been on TV and radio quite a lot over the years.
Okay, well, tell us, because Jimmy was one of your patients. That's what you're saying.
He was, I was looking after him in an isolation room, you know, one-to-one nursing because of his needs, really, you know, due to his burns.
God.
Yeah, and so I spent about 6 weeks looking after him, and I moved on then to a permanent
and
job.
And Rosemary, when you say looking after Jimmy, you mean you were with him all the time, you were on duty?
Yes, that's right, because he had extensive burns on his hands and arms mainly, and so obviously he wasn't able to do anything for himself, so I spent those, you know, my shifts, any other shifts that I was working was with him for those 6 weeks, and you know, he had a lot of I suppose needs, you know, I mean, you'd have to try and prevent complications, and all the dressings, as Tricia just spoke about there, the dressings took up quite a lot of time, and you know, he went through an awful lot, really. He was quite funny and had a good sense of humor, but he was also very brave. I mean, he was only 16 or 17.
Incredible.
And he'd had to cope with so much challenges, really, and facing into a long road of recovery, you know. But he was quite brave, you know.
And then I'm sure you must have been joyful in a poignant way, because Jimmy, anyone that's followed the Stardust, Jimmy, anytime I met Jimmy, he'd let you, he'd remind you, he'd the last time I met him, he told me to get up to the rotunda that I hadn't been seen for a few days, to get up there and sit with the family. You've seen him on telly. He is good. He's a good man.
Yes, that's right. He is. And I suppose, you know, yesterday when I was listening to the apology, I was thinking of his parents, really, you know, who I'd met over those few weeks. And I suppose I didn't realise then, as a 22-year-old, what it was like, really, even for the parents. I mean, Tricia spoke about the generation thing and how it impacts everybody. But, you know, for them to watch their young fella going through all that, you know, and facing into years of, you know, recovery of different aspects, physio and all these things that he would have needed after, you know, and occupational therapy and all that kind of thing. But I was thinking of the parents, really, and him, and, you know, they were very nice. I remember, as far as I can remember, I wouldn't be certain on this, but I think they both worked in Cadbury's.
Yeah, that's a lot of people there in the area,
Yeah, and my birthday fell in May, and I remember they coming in with the biggest box of Cadbury's chocolates I'd ever seen for me, you know. And he often had visitors coming in, and they were all the young people that were survivors of the fire, and they all spoke with, you know, husky voices, you know, due to the smoke damage and things like that.
And Rosemary, where were you yesterday when the Taoiseach was?
I was painting my living room.
Good moment.
And I switched on the radio and listened to it, and I was putting the roller up and down, and, you know, it was quite emotional, really, listening to it. But I thought he did a good job, and I thought it was quite thorough.
And you were thinking of Jimmy, obviously.
I was thinking of Jimmy, and I'm sure he was probably there. But
Were you there, Jimmy?
I was indeed.
Oh, gosh, Jimmy.
How are you, Rosemary?
I have a photograph of you, and you had lovely blonde wavy hair, and sitting
Sammy's
there in the hospital
goodbye to my
room.
Head.
I didn't recognise you when I first saw you on television. Yeah. You've none of that hair left.
No, that's your way goodbye to my head.
And Jimmy, do you remember Rosemary?
I most certainly do. I do indeed. Yeah, she was absolutely amazing, I have to say. I remember we had so many great laughs, and she was always keeping me in good form, and she was always attentive to me, and she was just amazing. As Rosemary knows, and as she just said there, I had agency nurses around the clock, so she'd be on shifts, you know, and I'd look forward to her coming in because we'd have a great bit of fun together, and because I knew it was going to be taken so well care of, and indeed I was, you know.
And Jimmy, Rosemary described you needed such was the seriousness of your injury, you needed one-to-one care. Were you aware that you were so seriously ill, John?
Yeah, I was. Yeah, like I was the worst born to survive, and the longest in hospital. I actually spent a long time in intensive care, and they had to remove all the skin from my arms and hands, in order to get grass done, but they couldn't shift me over to Stevenson's for grass because they would be afraid that the lungs would go again. So they had to make sure the lungs were right. So that in itself was traumatic because you have to look at your dressings every day being done on your arms and hands without skin. You know, it's a daunting thing, and it's very painful. And they have to sedate you all the time because it makes your lungs worse. Yeah. So it was horrendous, you know, what we all had to go through. But especially, like, that time I didn't realise, you know, what I thought, if I get to Stevens Hospital and I get my grafts, this will tell you the naivety of a 16-year-old. I thought I'd be brand new again. There'd be nothing wrong. Like, I didn't realise the road to recovery was going to be so arduous and so long, you know. Yeah. But yeah, so, yeah.
And so, yeah. Last Thursday afternoon began at 2 o'clock, and the verdict was read out at 3:05. What was your reaction, Jimmy?
Oh, it was euphoric, I have to say. It was just unbelievable. Like, I'm even getting emotional now thinking about it, because the families just screamed and hugged each other.
Yeah.
And we were just, it was just incredible. Like, in fairness to the coroner, she was absolutely very, very empathetic to us all the way through.
Yeah.
And she was amazing, you know, and when she said it, when she said to the foreman of the jury, you know, do we have a verdict? And don't read it out yet. And then he said, we do. Is the same verdict for all 48 families? And for all 48 victims.
Yeah.
And they said, it is. So she said, okay, hold it. Then she went through all of the victims individually, one by one.
Yeah.
And then she asked the foreman, foreman, you have reached the verdict, as you said. So can you tell us the verdict? And we were half expecting him to go into, well, we've reached the verdict. He just brought it straight out, unlawful killing.
Yeah.
So you can just imagine, there was a second of silence and then just an uproar of emotion.
Yeah.
It was tremendous, tremendous, truly was.
And then, you know, since then, Jimmy, you were in with the Taoiseach on Saturday.
Yeah.
And you met other politicians as well. And then yesterday in the Dáil. What's the week been like?
The week's been, I think I'm running on fumes at the moment, to be honest with you. There's a kind of an adrenaline that's just keeping us going, I suppose. You know, it's been full on, like, since last week and just before last week, because we were very pensive waiting on the result and waiting on them to say they have a verdict. And every time we were being told, you know, oh, they have another question, the jury have another question. Oh, should we be sending texts to everybody, like Louise McDermott, Selena McDermott would be texting me, I'd be texting them saying, not another question, we got to wait another day.
It
was like you were just anxious, you know, the nervous tension has been, like, keeping us going. And that's no joke. But it was just brilliant, you know.
And Jimmy, you must have been conscious yesterday that the leader of the country, the Taoiseach, delivering this apology on behalf of the Irish people.
Yeah.
Was born 21 years, I think, after you were.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah. So look, when we met him in government buildings next to the house there last Saturday, I did bring that to his attention. I did say, because we all got to say something to him.
Yeah, okay.
And he pointed at me and I suppose, not disrespectfully, he went Jimmy and I said Simon instead of on T-shirt.
Yeah, no,
but I didn't do it in a disrespectful manner. I just done it. Like, you called my name, somebody called your name, you repeat this.
Yeah.
So anyway, I spoke to him and said, Simon, I said, listen, I said, to be quite honest with you, I says, consecutive governments have kicked this can down the road, you know, and passed the baton back. Like, and we've been, you know, we've been definitely on this campaign for such a long time.
Yeah.
I've been on it from the very start with John Keegan, you know, and I've done today, tonight, and I've done the programme Anything Goes, and different various newspapers, articles, and so on and so forth. But, like, for me, it was like, he's now listening because he has to, because now we've got the just result.
Yeah,
so instead, he didn't turn a blind eye to it. He did listen, and he came back to us fairly quickly to talk to us, you know.
Yeah.
And he did listen. But I did say to him, look, this is not aimed at you. We know this was not, you know, this wasn't on your shift. Right?
Okay,
this didn't happen on your shift. You weren't even born. I said, you were in God's pocket. So, like, he got a great laugh out of that because, like, he just realised, oh my God, he's right. I wasn't even around, like, you know. But, like, in fairness, like, he did listen and he did take on board everything that we wanted in the apology, because we needed I think we got a robust and a transparent and a genuine kind of apology from the state. And I think it took 43 years to get, but it's here. You know, we have it now. And as other people have said, and I can definitely without doubt say this, you know, 43 years of people campaigning, that should never happen to any mother, child, sister, brother, to be doing that in the cold and the rain, like, and constantly doing it for answers, and all because we were walking past people, you know.
And we all knew you were in hospital, Jimmy, when the inquiry was going up. The Keane Tribunal was on up in the Incorporated Law Society. Anyone who attended that, which I did, I was only 22 because I'm working on the student magazine and went up every day with a couple of other lads. It was obvious. That the, yeah, that, you, that, that the 48 had been locked. It was obvious that the doors were locked. It was obvious that there was no arson, as the Butterleys tried to argue. That was their main argument, as you know. That was always the agenda.
The dog in the street could have told you as well. But they shifted the blame to the patrons. You know, on the night they shifted the blame to the victims and the people that died. And I know, Joe. Listen, as I said, the dog in the street could have told you it was wrong. But there, in that sentence, I'm going to say now everybody knows it was completely wrong because now it's in the public record.
It was unlawful.
It's in the public record forever.
It was unlawful killing. And Jimmy, how are you now?
I'm good. I just keep going as your. Your other caller said earlier on.
That's Tricia O'Connor.
My apologies. I just went down my head for a second. Sorry, Tricia, my apologies. As Tricia said, it's just like this far on. And for me to be saying I'm okay, I took great admiration and I get great strength from the families. You know, the mothers and fathers that are left. But they say the same about me, that me being on the joint with them gives them great strength, you know.
And your sense of humour and your don't know how you do it, but your sense of humour, your great outlook on life, the fact that you were... How long were you in hospital for, Jimmy?
I was in hospital until the June of 81.
February, March, April, May, June, my God.
Yeah.
And have you had to go back in and out since?
I did have to go back in and out for quite a while after that, back to Stevens Hospital for corrective surgery, and to really release some grass so I could get proper grips to my fingers and stuff. But
and how did you manage? Rosemary said she, and you remember the banter between the two of you. How did you manage that, Jimmy, given the extent of your injuries? I know you're only 16, and you probably say it was only a kid, and that's the way I was about life.
But no. Okay. Well, I always was happy, go lucky and outgoing, because I remember somebody had said to me, "Mum, Jimmy's always in good form. How is he always in good form? Is that since the fire?" My mum says, "No, he was always like that." It was just me. It was just
brilliant,
me the way I am. I'm blessed to be like that. Not everyone is.
Yeah.
So I'm thankful, you know, to God that I am, you know, like that. And I don't want to sound like a lion from Braveheart. They can take away everything else, but they can't take away me sense of humour.
Okay. and you look like Mel Gibson. You're a very handsome man, Jimmy. Very handsome man. Very handsome, last time I saw you. Okay, stay with us, because Patricia, Tricia O'Connor is staying with us. Rosemary, the nurse that tended to you like so many of them, Jimmy, is staying with us. And then I also want you to talk and say hello to Alison Glenn, who's in the UK, but she's the sister of Josephine Glenn, whose name, as we remarked yesterday, unfortunately, his name is spelled incorrectly on the memorial in Beaumont Hospital. And we're definitely going to move heaven and earth to get the name corrected and the memorial, fair play to Beaumont. They did it before, a lot of other people did it. Yeah. And we get the memorial properly, as every memorial should be, every 5 or 6 years, cleaned up, and we'll get the name corrected. Stay with us and we'll talk to Alison Glenn after this break.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
And Joe at RT.ie, we're talking to a number of survivors of the start of that night, Tricia O'Connor. Jimmy Fitzpatrick is also on the line on one of the nurses that looked after so many, including Jimmy, Rosemary. Jimmy, do you know how you escaped that night from the Stardust?
I do, yeah. I do indeed, yeah. I actually got into the foyer, into the hallway, and I was about 3 foot from the door, which I was almost out. But on the way out, I passed two friends that were screaming and going nowhere, so I kind of ran back to get them and throw them into the hallway. Because everybody was starting to panic and pushed away into the same place. Because everybody, you know, when you're that young, you only know the one way in and out. Because it's the door you come in, it's the door you're going out. So they were screaming, going nowhere, and I threw them into that passageway and they got carried out into the foyer. And I then fell over a handbag or a coat. To this day, I can't identify exactly which one I fell over. But I went to the ground and that. As Tricia said earlier, the lights suddenly went out. There was a massive bang and the lights went out. and then you were in pitch darkness, and pandemonium and mayhem is happening. People are running across my back. I can't get up, so I had to crawl to the left. Now, when I fell, I'm facing the door, but when I crawled to the left, I realised I'm going the wrong way because I'm on a wooden floor. I knew I was back on the dance floor.
Okay.
So I didn't know what to do. So I jumped up again, got another gust of horrible thick black smoke, which could absolutely chew. And I was born, and so I fell again to the ground. But this time I could breathe on the ground because there's about 6 inches of air down there.
Okay.
And I just done, you know, the best way to describe it would be like crawling, like an army crawl on your arms.
Yeah.
So that's all I could do was just keep crawling till I was bumping into things all the time, but it was still falling all on top of us. And then I got to a doorway that people were kicking, and I jumped up and just kept kicking with them, and we all fell out the exit. Yeah, so there was a chain on the door.
Yeah. And Jimmy, when did you realise how many of your neighbours and friends had died?
This is ironic. I was sitting with David Morton's brother yesterday, Alan, who I hadn't seen up to now since the fire.
Okay.
And we were chatting, and David was a great friend of mine, and we were chatting away, and I was saying to him, I was in Stephen's Hospital, and I was like mummified because I was bandaged head to toe, and there was a young guy, a young child beside us. I'd say he was about 12, because he was in our ward, and he was about 12. He was obviously having a graft to his arm. But the Stardust came on the television, and he said to me, my neighbour died in that. I says, your neighbour? And he goes, yeah. I said, what's your neighbour's name? And he went, David Morton. And that's how I found out about David. And little did I know that my mum and dad were going to funerals, changing their clothes and coming back up to me, because they were wearing black to funerals. But, you know, because back then everybody wore black to funerals. And they would go to my friend's funerals and then come up to see me in hospital. And they never told me they couldn't, like, you know, yeah. It was in a bad way. And then when I got back to the Mater Hospital, when I was with the lovely Rosemary and all the angels that looked after us, when I was sitting in the ward one day, there was another physiotherapist came in, and she said, how are you getting on? How are you keeping? And she says, great. And I said, Do you know anything about Liam, my friend Liam Dunn? Yeah. And she went, oh, Liam was a lovely guy. And I went, what do you mean, was a lovely guy? How do you mean? And she said, is he still home? Is he gone home or in the hospital? And she said, I don't know. I'll have to check it. She couldn't break the news to me then.
Yeah.
And then when Mum and Dad came up, they came in, they see me crying, they realised somebody's told them. So then they had to tell me about the rest of them because, like, it was just, people were not telling me. You know, so that was I think it was about April or May when I started hearing all the news.
Stay with us, Jimmy, please, and Rosemary and Tricia. I'll go to Alison Glenn. Alison, good afternoon. I know it's a good line, hopefully now. How are you, Alison?
Hiya.
Yeah, good.
Hiya. Yeah, I'm fine, thank you.
And remembering Josephine, of course. What's been your reaction to the last week, Alison?
Well, we made it over for the verdicts on Thursday, and it was the news we wanted. We wanted the truth and some justice, and we got it. And to be honest, it felt fantastic, but just, you know, tinged with the sadness that my mother couldn't have been there and heard that. So yeah, but it's good.
And then the apology yesterday.
I'm
sure you appreciated that it was at last the names were engraved in stone, in not only on the Dáil record, but in the hearts of so many people as well.
Yeah.
Alison, the family mentioned, and I said this yesterday, the family mentioned in your pen portrait of dear Josephine, that there was a memorial, as you know, in Beaumont Hospital.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to get the exact date when it was erected. I think it was around 30 years ago. And then on the day, there was the names are again carved in stone. But your family were upset that time because Josephine's surname, your surname, Glenn, was spelt incorrectly.
Yeah.
When did you realise the spelling was wrong, Alison?
Somebody told us. I can't remember, yeah, to be quite honest, who it was. But you know, it seems trivial, maybe to other people, but it's you know, it's there to be in stone forever, and it would be nice to have it put right.
Yeah.
I know, and
I've said it over the last few days, and I know people might think one letter, the letter N, the superfluous letter N, but it's the most important thing you have. The first thing you do when you get your new pen or pencil is write down your own name. The one thing you will never do, if you are able to read and write, the one thing you'll never do is misspell your own name. Your family know your own name, and if you went to a headstone and saw the relative of yours with a misspelling, you'd be grievously upset. And have you? Yeah. I know you have, and it's in a hospital, and it's a lovely little oasis. You can't access it. You look at it through glass, and I'm sure hospitals change and are very, very busy places. I'm sure have you drawn it to the attention of the hospital over the years, Alison, and have you any connection with the hospital?
Well, my brother did a long time ago, but he can't even remember who he, you know, contacted to try and do it. And I think my nephew Stuart works at the hospital too. And I think he have tried, but to no avail. So, you know, I mean, we moved away quite a long time ago from Ireland. So it's quite, it's quite sort of difficult to, when we go over, we only have a couple of days and, you know, certain things we've got to attend or whatever. So
I can tell you, Alison and Josephine's family, that we have a stonemason that will go in with the cooperation of Beaumont, and they will cooperate, of course, that will go in and rectify the mistake at last. I know it's been a long time.
Aww.
And that's Katie. Oh. Katie Doyle is from Mount Jerome Monumentals.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Katie, good afternoon. Katie, we sent you photographs of the monument. And I know yourself and your brother, there's an expert team in Mount Jerome. Is it fixable?
Well, hi Joe. Hi Alison. We had a look at the photographs, and what we would do is we would sand down the name and level it out, and then we hand carved. They're hand carved Garamond letters.
Oh,
and
lovely.
We would re-hand carve them back onto the stone. And also, because of the type of stone it is, it looks to us like it's a Kilkenny limestone.
Okay.
And when you clean just a little section of that, it comes up in kind of a very clean kind of bright colour.
Great.
So the best thing to do is to clean the whole plaque.
Oh, well done.
In order for it to come back up exactly the same as all the rest of the names. And then, because I think there are three plaques.
Yeah, but the names.
So
yeah.
we're going to clean the three plaques.
Oh, well done. Well done.
Yeah.
And it is limestone. And Alison, I hope, well, it will be done as soon as possible. And I hope your family are able to come and be there.
Yeah, we'll do it in the coming weeks.
Oh, will you? Okay.
And we'll do it in the coming weeks.
And is it? Will it be noticeable, Katie? Sorry, I know these are stupid questions, but will it be? I suspect from what you're saying, it won't be.
No, it won't be. It won't be noticeable because the where Josephine's name's, it's very close to the bottom of the headstone or the bottom of the plaque.
That particular plaque,
So it's there's another name beside it, and it's Michael, and what we will do is we will just rub it down level.
Okay.
From there's a space between Josephine's name and the name above it.
Yeah.
So
we'll
just sand it down level, the same as you would sand down furniture, like a veneer, and you would just sand it down and get it level, and then recarve it back, then the names, two names back onto it. So it won't be noticed. But, well, we'll know.
Because, of course.
An ordinary person looking at the head at the stone wouldn't know.
And by the way, Katie, an aside, does it happen often that names are misspelled on headstones? Or?
Well, it wouldn't happen very often, but it does happen.
Yeah.
And depending on what type of stone it is, like if it was polished, say polished black, that's very hard to rectify.
Yeah, I can imagine.
It has, the stone has to be taken down and put under a big polishing machine and repolished. And all the whole section around it would have to be repolished as well. Whereas that, we won't even have to take the plaques down off the wall.
Oh, fantastic.
All that work can be done whilst the plaques are in place.
Okay. And are you, Alison, I don't want to put you on the spot, but as Josephine's family, are you agreeable to that being done?
Oh, absolutely. I'm absolutely overwhelmed. Thank you very much for doing that. And to your firm, Katie, thank you.
It's Mount Jerome, which is probably the base in Harold's Cross. Alison, tell us a little bit about Josephine. She was 16 years of age, from Coolock. What was the age difference between you and Josephine?
There was just over a year between me and Joe. We were very close, We were pretty much like twins when we were younger.
Was she working?
She was, She was working in Maritime Sweet Factory.
What type of factory?
Sweet Factory.
Oh, Sweet Factory, yeah.
Making the sweets, yeah.
And was she...
She
was going out to work. She was working at an early age, I know. And she, I presume, like anyone at that age, Alison, you remember, you had to hand up your money to your mother. Hand up your money.
That's right. That's what everybody did at that point.
Yeah.
You know, so.
And when do you remember? Yeah. Do you remember the night, Alison?
I do remember the night. But I was in England at the time. And kind of always regretted being away because I always looked after Joe. I wasn't there that night to look after her. So,
and would you have gone to the Stardust with her?
I could possibly have.
Yeah, yeah.
Who knows, you know? But she wasn't supposed to be there that night.
Oh,
she told me because I'd spoken to her on the phone. I'd spoken to her on the phone on the Tuesday before. And she said she was going on the Saturday night.
Right.
So, of course, when I seen it on the news, I said to my family that she can't, you know, she can't be there because she's supposed to be going Saturday. So, and then it wasn't until the police came to the door and said she was in a coma. So we flew out then as soon as we could.
And Alison, was your mother still with us at the time? Your parents, were they still alive? Yeah, well, they would have been quite young as well, you see. All the people who were unlawfully killed in the Stardust were very young, very young, very young.
My mother would have been 40 at the time,
young woman.
Alison,
with your permission, we'll keep in touch. Beaumont is a fantastic, fantastic institution, a fantastic hospital in the country. The hospital is a busy hospital, and we liaise with Beaumont. We liaise, and as you say, you have a relative working there, so I hope he will get involved as well. The Mount Jerome Monumentals are highly regarded. They're fully qualified. They'll do a great job. Katie and Bernard, who's our brother Bernard Doyle, they'll do a great job, and maybe we can arrange the families, maybe we can arrange a rededication of the memorial in Beaumont Hospital with everything done in the best possible way. But Alison Glenn, thank you so much, and may Josephine's soul rest in peace, Alison. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you, Katie.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Well done, Katie. Well done. It's really appreciated. When I said it at 20-1 there, when I was saying it to Jay, Shay, is there a stonemason that would help? You're brilliant. And by the way, others have offered as well. But thank you so much, Katie, and we'll keep in touch. We'll be back after this break.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Joe Duffy!
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Tony, good afternoon.
How are you, Joe?
How are you? It's been a difficult time for the families, the survivors, as we heard. Was your cousin 17 years of age, Paula Bourne, who was unlawfully killed in the Stardust?
Correct, Joe. And there was a strange story attached to it. Myself and my wife-to-be were supposed to go to the Stardust that night.
Okay.
And our marriage guidance course, you probably remember them things, was down in Marino on the 14th.
Yeah.
And my wife-to-be lived in Kilbarrick, so we came down the Howth Road to Marino. Came up the back of Sweeney in 4 days.
Yeah, no.
And went into this, the marriage guide, of course. Knew nothing about this.
Yeah.
And we're driving home and wondering what the fire brigade is there for.
Yeah.
Eventually, when I got to my mum's in her town, we were told what happened. And it was the Saturday evening we found out Paula was missing. Yeah. And I remember going on a Monday with my cousin Paddy, Pat Bourne. He was a chef. And we were standing outside the morgue for about 6 hours. And apparently she was one of the last to be identified. And there's another little story to it that never made the papers. Yeah. A friend of mine, a mechanic, right, I'm not going to mention his name or anything. He broke into a JCB at the side of the building to try and drag off the bars from the windows.
Yeah.
And he was arrested.
And remember,
he was actually arrested.
And Tony, remember, during this inquest, it emerged, and it was said as well 43 years ago at the Keane Tribunal, that the buttery said the reason they put the bars on the toilet windows, the small tile, well, there would have been a way to escape, and they were pretty sturdy bars. Even the fire brigade had great difficulty trying to dislodge them. And the reason they put the bars on the toilet windows is that you needed a tie to get a necktie to get into the Stardust. And the lads were, if you didn't have a necktie, they were passing out a necktie to their mates, which is a laughable reason. Horrific reason to be part.
About 3 or 4 weeks prior to that, I went to see the Gene Pitney concert there.
Okay.
I hadn't got a tie on me.
That was crazy. But what are your memories of Paula?
Ah, she was an angel. And when I seen her picture in the paper the other day, she's the spitting image of her sister Maria. Yeah.
Killed her mother. Yeah. And in the portrait that the family gave at the start of the inquest, she devoted to her family love, fashion, dancing, drawing, her school books full of doodles. And they said there's one word, and I know you say this as well, there's one word that summed up Paula, and that would be kindness, Tony. Kindness.
Oh, she was just the genuine person.
I want to go to, thanks, Tony. Declan, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe. How are you?
Good. You have a connection through your family with Dublin Fire Brigade.
I do indeed, yeah. My wonderful late father, Terry, and his twin brother Michael were district officers in Dublin Fire Brigade for a combined 70 years between them, I think, more or less. And it's funny, and first of all, I'm listening to Tony today. I'm very close to tears myself because of the pure emotion that's come out with the inquest and the truth coming out at last. I want to say to anybody who's anyway, your justice is being served, and your family names are finally being cleared in the way they should have been many, many years ago. But my link, I was sending a message to your show yesterday just to say, I think you were speaking to an officer from North Strand, Dublin Fire Brigade officer, and I was literally just going to write to say that we don't hear enough about the emergency services, not just the fire brigade, but everyone, the Gardaí, the hospital staff, everyone involved in that horrific night and the aftermath, and the pure overwhelmingness of it, I suppose. You know, it must have been absolutely terrible. I remember I was 12 years old at the time, and I remember waking up the Saturday morning, and I used to sneak downstairs to watch the early morning cartoons before anybody else got up, and the Stardust was all over the news, all over the television. Course, but you know, you remember so little from being 12 years old. But my father was on duty that night, and I don't have clear memory of him coming home at a certain time. But the one thing Dublin Fire Brigade officers that I knew, they didn't come home and do any post-match analysis. You know, it was part of their job.
Yeah, because they had another shift probably 8 or 9 hours later. Yeah,
they had to come home and cut the grass and, you know, live their life and then go back to work again. And I'm sure it's still the same today. I just think they are.
And did your dad ever talk about it?
No. To be honest with you, he would never have burdened his family with his woes from work, because I think they were conditioned to that.
Yeah.
Right the way through. Stardust obviously was unique, but nothing. I mean, there was tragedies every day of the week. They saved lives. They lost lives. You know, and they still live, and they still do. And they would never come home and say, "Wait, let's tell you what happened today." You know, so and so happened, or someone died, or something.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know, you didn't ever expect that kind of "tell us what happened in work today, Dad." You know, it just you wouldn't ask that question.
Yeah.
They did what they did, and I don't know what level of grief counselling or support they ever had back in that day, but I'd imagine very little.
And
is
your dad still with us, Declan?
No, he passed away in 2016.
Because I tell you, the last time I met your dad was at the funeral of his twin, Michael.
That's right.
In Finglas. And of course, the remarkable thing about Declan, your dad, and Michael, they were identical, weren't they?
Absolutely.
Well, to me they were anyway.
Well, absolutely. Although they would have been quick to tell you they weren't identical.
I know that. But I remember going, because your uncle, Michael, is the father of Jenny. Jenny Gibney, who's married to Brendan O'Carroll. So,
that's right.
And Brendan, as you know, and Jenny were extraordinarily fond of Michael. And obviously, as friends, we all went to the funeral. And I remember walking up to the church in Finglas, and around the corner came your dad, Terry. And I was knocked for six, because I thought it was Michael, the man we were. And the two of them, as you say, gave great, great service. I remember your Uncle Michael talking to us on Liveline, Declan, about the Noyax fire in 1974 at the bottom of Dominic Street. And the heroic, 9 people died in that. And the heroic efforts of him and all his colleagues in Dublin Fire Brigade to try and they did save people, but the 9 office workers upstairs were trapped, unfortunately. Declan, thank you for that. Thank you for that memory.
And
above
listen,
all, thank you
if
for.
I could just say the reason I wanted to call you, and it's not to prolong it, but I do hope, and I'm not aware of what has or hasn't been done, but I do hope the emergency services get due recognition through whatever memorials are created, and not taken away from anything else that's done. The victims
of
fire, obviously, the most important people in the story, but there are other people who deserve some form of recognition as well. And I just hope that is on the agenda somewhere, somehow. But it looks like
Declan, there's going to be a national day. I don't know whether I don't think we should wait until next February. I think there should be a national day, and everyone that rightly deserves to be commemorated and honoured will happen on that day, and maybe there'll be a special medal struck or whatever for everyone involved. Declan Gibney, to your family, your great family, your two uncles, the identical twins, two district officers, which is a serious job, and every job in Dublin Fire Brigade and every fire service is a serious job, but well done, and thank you for your service, and thank you for that contribution. That's Declan Gibney in Wexford.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Jimmy, what happens now, Jimmy? It's after the week that's in it. I just wonder.
We hope. I think going forward that
that Solicitor Gary Macken would be pushing the government to look for a criminal investigation, because there was never a criminal investigation done into the Stardust. And now that there's 48 deaths recorded as unlawful killing, that's a tentative.
That's got to be decided, and it will be decided by the Gardaí and above all by the Director of Public.
What's
ahead for you, Jimmy, and the families? Do you want a National Day of Commemoration? Do you want...
Absolutely, and there should be. I mean, it's a day of recognition, and it's also a day of recognition for the first responders, the nurses, the doctors. Yeah. They were all our heroes too. Like, without them, you know, a lot of us wouldn't have survived. And the care and attention that they put in, but the first responders on the night, and taxi men, like the community of Dublin just pulled together, and fairly rapidly too for us. But then we were left behind by the government, you know.
Well, I think if there is, and I hope there is, a national day, and I hope there is a national commemoration, Jimmy. Hundreds of thousands of people, if they're able to get there or even not there, will march arm in arm with you and all the survivors and the families of the Stardust. Indeed. And Tricia, I hope you realise that as well. I think you do. People will walk very soon, either in their hearts today listening to you or else arm in arm on a National Day of Commemoration. Tricia, people will walk arm in arm with you.
I know, I hear you, Joe, I do. And I'd just like to say thanks to Jimmy and the other people that have carried this for all those years. I have carried that campaign, because what happened yesterday, none of the inquest, none of it would have been possible without any of them. No, it wouldn't have. So I just want to say that, you know.
Go safely, Trish, your family, your beautiful grandchildren, Tricia. Go safely, all of you, and we'll see you soon, I hope, on Sound today. Liam Mullen, broadcast coordinator, Shane Galvin, research, Richard Byrne, producer, Annette Egan, and Ray Darcy's next.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Elevate your bedroom with our fresh new bedding designs and colours, in-store and online at harrycurry.com.
0818 715 815. Stays open until 3:15 p.m. or email joe@rte.ie.